We have been talking all morning about the rebuke to the European project and their own political class as British voters defied opinion polls and market expectations and chose to leave the European Union by a decisive margin. The result, the first time any member of the 28-nation EU has chosen to leave the Union, will certainly have repercussions for both Britain and the EU. And to discuss that in depth, we welcome Dr. Stephen Lebo, professor of international history and politics at the Sage Colleges, as well as a regular WAMC commentator. Stephen, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you very much for being with us. When we look at this in the context of the EU, how we came to the EU, how the UK came to the EU in its creation, what does this tell us now that we have a nation that has said, enough, we're leaving?
Well, I think the central issue is to remember that the British were always phenomenally ambivalent about, number one, their relationship with the continent. It was easy to buy books that would say the history of Europe in Britain that didn't have Britain in it. They were very late to entering the common market. So there's always been an enormous amount of ambivalence about their relationship with the European Union. But I think that on a kind of a larger issue, what we're seeing, and this plays out very dramatically, is that in recent years, you've seen what some people have called sort of the Americanization of Europe. And by that, European societies that are becoming far more diverse than they once were. And for a great many people, that's very attractive. There's more restaurants and more diverse culture. But at the essence of this issue has been the issue of identity. These societies are changing. I mean, the first time I spent any time in Britain was the early 70s. There were hardly that many groups from elsewhere. By the mid-90s, I was teaching a class with Sage and SUNY students at Oxford on the role of South Asians in contemporary Indian culture. In recent years, of course, that has expanded enormously. And I think one of the big problems that we've been hearing a lot about is, people voted against their wallet. They were told this economically was going to be a problem if they voted to leave. But when you've got identity competing with economics, identity usually does win. And remember what just happened. We had a very close vote. It was close to being a tie.
52-48.
Yeah, so if you've got a country that has been historically ambivalent and you're living in a world where identity is becoming more challenged, and then what do we have in a larger world? Enormous numbers of people on the move because of violence in the Middle East, climate change in the Middle East, Egypt and Syria, people coming up from Africa. And so you've got an enormously more larger number of people who are nervous about immigration. And that has become an issue. It's becoming an issue in the United States, obviously, with the Trump campaign. So if you've just got a scale where it's about 50-50, there's been decades of ambivalence, and then you see enormously larger numbers of people coming in legally or illegally, it's not surprising that that sort of extra thumb on the scale brought us to where we are today.
It is, when you look at it as a whole, sure, but one nation that has decided to leave the EU. But to look at what you just said and that idea of, okay, we're going to do it alone. Well, what if everybody decides that, okay, let's try and do it alone?
Well, there's no question. Well, certainly from the Russian perspective, that's advantageous. A weaker, less unified Europe makes Russia's return to influence more important. But I think the one thing that hasn't been talked about a lot is the simple fact that now we have a couple of years. There's supposed to be 2 years to negotiate this thing. And, of course, the British, in a sense, you want to have your cake and eat it too. But the bottom line is they're going to try to gain the advantages they have and recognize of membership in the European Union while losing the disadvantages, control over borders, over regulation, things of that sort. But the perspective of the entire European Union in large measure is going to be wanting to make that very difficult and very painful, not necessarily because they're mad at Britain, but they want the message to go out to all those other countries, particularly those that could actually leave, a France, a Germany, that could survive well on their own. And so this is going to be a very, very tough negotiation with the European Union wanting to exact a very high price.
What about nations who have been trying to enter the European Union, like Turkey?
Well, there's no question about that. And the Turks have kind of gone back and forth about that. And part of this is the Turks have tried to disassociate themselves with the Middle East, become part of the European Union. On the other hand, the Turks, because they're the largest single Muslim community within Europe, not very much in Europe, but in Europe, has been part of that sense that Europe is becoming something very different than historic Europe. And, you know, we have to recognize that this sense of identity, are we still who we are? America is a culture that was built on an enormous range of different kinds of people, and we've had an enormous amount of problems trying to assimilate that community. I mean, I'm right now finishing a novel on the Chinese Exclusion Act. So this issue of identity and jobs, these are very powerful forces. You add that to a world where, you know, when I was born, there were 2.3 billion people on the planet. Now it's 7+ who are increasingly, because of things like climate change, having trouble supporting themselves and are on the move. That's a very big thumb on the scale of identities feeling threatened.
So let's just look at an issue like climate change. I know that you work very extensively in this on the subject and on this issue. And I want to use it as an example. But if we are to come together as a global community and tackle a problem, is it overreaching by saying that votes like this one damage those efforts to try to come together to work on the world's problems?
Well, I think human beings do not identify with Homo sapiens. I mean, we spent a couple hundred thousand years walking around with 20 or 30 people. There's some psychological studies, anthropological studies, that says about the maximum we can handle is 150. And so in times of stress, and this is what is occurring in terms of population stress, climate change, crop failures, people are less likely to embrace a universal embrace of Homo sapiens and return to this kind of powerful sense of tribalism, which is a big part of who we are.
So that idea of who we are, do we know what that is anymore?
I think that who we are has become phenomenally threatened, and that's what we know, a sense of being threatened. But I think that the biggest thing that we need to get out of this is that these kinds of challenges, the rise of nervousness about immigration, large numbers of people on the move trying to find a better life because what they had before has collapsed, this is going to be facing, and it's facing us in the United States, it's facing the British, this is a global phenomenon. And we've got to work our way through how do we balance the preservation of the societies as we've developed to be French or Polish or Chinese or whatever it is, with this enormous number of people that are increasingly on the move in a world where resources are more and more stressed. This is not the last time something like this is going to happen. You are going to get something like, let's say, during the Depression, when people were closing their doors, raising tariffs, Harley Smoot, things of that sort. This is one of the single biggest challenges we have to face. It's playing out in Britain. It's playing out in the United States. And it's not something you can go away by just deciding, you know, to be multicultural. This is a real issue.
And as we try to figure that out, we are, in the meantime, making really important, huge decisions of saying that as people are, as you say, moving around and moving from place to place, that, okay, well, you're doing that, we're not going to let you in.
That is going to be, and the numbers that are going to be trying to get in,
yes,
to various places is going to grow enormously over the next decade, because we have this exploding population and an exploding crisis, which makes it harder and harder for people to, at home, survive. No one wants to go off in this incredibly dangerous effort to leave Central Africa or Syria or Iraq to work their way through, walking their way through, you know, the Balkans to England. And yet we've got people trying to smuggle themselves in, climbing into lorries, on the inside of lorries, to try and get across the channel. we are in a period that is only going to grow of global stress. And that movement is going to clash against that sense of identity, which is so powerful in the human condition.
Much of what you're talking about in that clash, and as you say, we're looking at 2 years before we hammer out even the details on this particular exit, and what about future exits? What about just the stability of the EU as a whole? But when you use the word clash, I mean, certainly much of the discussion that took place during this vote and the debate had to do with, what is this going to do with us in fighting with one another, with a concern over the ability for us to sustain peace?
Well, at the core, and this comes down to, where did the European Union come from? You know, where did the common market come from? Going backwards, where did the European iron and steel community come from? It wasn't England. It was France and Germany after World War I and World War II. Schuman and Jean Monnet came together and said, you know, if we have this European coal and steel community, we can maybe lock ourselves economically and industrially together so that we don't have a clash of nationalisms that had happened over and over again for hundreds of years for older people. For many of us, the essence of the European community is not the economic advantages. It's the advantages of not exploding in literally centuries of European warfare. The power of nationalism is very significant in that very small space.
What do you think the EU as a body did that was negligent to its member countries, like England?
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, it's the same problem we have in the United States with federalism. You have... If the nation states of Europe were the equivalent of states, which some of them were originally, there was that sense of an overregulation as they tried to sort of harmonize all sorts of different practices that were done differently in different countries and make everything work the same across Europe. I mean, those kinds of irritations and clashes on, you know, regulations and how you did this or that or make this or prepare that, those were the kinds of day-to-day things that people found very, very irritating. This gigantic bureaucracy that was far, you know, much farther away. You were voting for a member of parliament or you're voting for a prime minister who had significantly less power to control economic activities right there in Kent, for example. And that, by definition, is irritating in the same way that people, you know, from Texas to Oregon are occasionally angry with the United States. And I think in those kind of circumstances, it's easy to focus on the irritations and take the advantages for granted.
So it's a necessary evil.
Well, I don't think that Europe could go from a bunch of small countries that had lost their empires, that was operating in a world with a giant Soviet Union, a United States that had been diminished by historical changes and wanted to become part of something larger so that they could play a role, a largest market in the world. There were an enormous number of advantages. The problem is, though, I think that, and this is what human beings do all the time, you notice what irritates you, and you simply take for granted the advantages. But as I'm saying, this is playing out in a country that has always never quite considered itself part of Europe, 50-50, and you add the stresses, those images of large numbers of migrants on the move. You throw away the paranoia of jihadists, you know, the occasional jihadist slipping in this group or that group. Those are incredibly volatile things, and yet, realistically, even under those circumstances, it was still awfully close. But now we're going to move into a very different universe.
Dr. Stephen Lebo is professor of international history and politics at Sage Colleges and, of course, a regular WAMC commentator. We will continue our conversation with him after this short break.
Support comes from Saratoga Hospital, now offering 3D mammography technology for early detection of breast cancer. SaratogaHospital.org for information. Gristmill Real Estate Socrates. For over 40 years, a locally owned independent realtor offering one-on-one consultations for buyers and sellers, specializing in homes in Socrates, Woodstock, Kingston, and beyond. GristmillRealEstate.com. Foresight Land Services. For over 45 years, offering civil engineering, land surveying, planning, and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and Eastern New York. ForesightLand.com. And Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington. Offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community. Berkshire.coop.
Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable as we are in the last segment of our coverage on the Brexit and coverage of what happened yesterday and today in the UK. Dr. Stephen Lebow is our guest, professor of international history as well as politics at the Sage Colleges, a regular WAMC commentator, and always great to have Stephen on our programs. When we think about the 48%, let's actually focus on the 52% of the people who voted to leave the EU in the UK in the voting that took place yesterday. They wanted something else. What was because in this jubilation on their part, there doesn't seem to be an articulation, at least, of exactly what it is that they now want. And you alluded to this a moment ago. They know what they don't want, but do they know what they want and how they're going to achieve it?
Oh, I think there's absolute certainty that they don't. But what there is, I think, a worldwide reaction to a phenomenon that began in the 1990s, and we call it globalization.
Yes.
And that globalization with FedEx and trucks that take across the world and the collapse of communism in the People's Republic, the internet, we have seen a situation where the world's economies and the world's jobs and everything else have become phenomenally, overwhelmingly in flux. And we've got large numbers of people who are uncertain about their jobs. They're seeing their jobs go elsewhere. And it's very hard to, you know, listen to a professor giving you a lecture on the origins of globalization. It's easier to blame somebody. And in Americans, we often spell globalization C-H-I-N-A, China, for example.
Yes.
Or more recently in this campaign, it was China and it was trade. But we're living in a globalized world where corporations, whether there's a good trade agreement or a bad trade agreement, can simply easily move from one continent to one labor force to another. And that has created, I think, an extraordinary level of insecurity for people from the United States to Britain, and it's been particularly big in Latin America. And we're going through that stress, and people like to blame someone. We just saw the Trump campaign and the Sanders campaign feeding off of all sorts of angry groups whose the only thing that really distinguished the difference was who they blamed for the problem. You know, Trump liked to blame, you know, the Chinese, and Sanders was Wall Street. They both agreed on trade agreements. But that sense, and it's not, you know, the old line, it's not paranoia if they're really out to get you.
Right.
We are living in a world which is being transformed overwhelmingly. And the next world, the next step is artificial intelligence and its ability to challenge jobs that most of us, or so many of us, do. The whole world of robo-sourcing and AI. We're moving into a world where how we understood how we were going to live or become successful or employ ourselves or pay our mortgage is being very challenged.
So I'm going to ask you a very simplistic question, and I hope it's not too simplistic, but it's just the thing that stays with me throughout this, and it has to do with what's going on in this country, what is going on in our electoral politics, what's going on the House floor when it comes to guns, what is happening in England and what is happening across Europe, of why we are so divided, of why we have that. Yes, it was 48-52, but let's just look at it and say it's a pretty even split. What do we do about that?
Well, I think we're just seeing an enormous amount of polarization. And in this completely new world, remember, the United States did a great job in the 20th century of how the world economy worked. But the way the world economy works now, an awful lot of the advantages we have are equally available to people across the planet. We're getting this incredible shift. So people are extremely frustrated. They're feeling threatened. And all of the traditional authorities, whether it was the leaders in the IMF or the Bank of Britain or all those kinds of things, or the prime ministers in the United States, almost all of those sources of authority are being challenged. And people are kind of responding in a kind of a visceral anger, looking for someone to be angry with. I'm actually editing with a colleague of mine a book on angry groups, and it's not particularly rational. I mean, you mentioned the gun battle.
Yes.
You know, it's not about whether a pistol or a 22 or a 32 is different than an assault weapon. Rationally, oh yes, of course, it's obviously different. It's not for hunting. But it's not about rationalism. It is about people angry and not trusting the other side, however they define the other side. We're really good at putting the other out there and deciding there's our group and their group and rational arguments. Oh, this will impact the economy by 8%. They don't go anywhere when you're dealing with group identity.
So with that in mind, where do we go from here? Because there has to be, it seems as though the anger here, at least in the vote that we saw yesterday that we're talking about this morning, is just starting to manifest itself. As we just indicated, without much of a roadmap. So where do we go to ultimately come to some peace and to some fluidity in working together?
You know, I remember being told as a child that the first thing you have to do to solve a problem is know you have one. And we have to recognize we're moving into this world where more and more people are going to be on the move, where more people's jobs are going to be threatened. They're going to be threatened by immigrants or outsourcing or robo-sourcing or artificial intelligence or climate change. And we need, in a sense, to plan for a world of significant change. It's like in a narrow sense, it's one thing to try to mitigate climate change, reduce the amount of carbon print, but we've got to walk into that world of adaptation because the 21st century is increasingly turning out, because of everything from the internet to climate change and population explosions, to be a very different world. And what worked in the 20th century is not going to work in the 21st.
You are, of course, a commentator here on WAMC, and I'm sure you'll be talking about this in the weeks and months to come. But when it comes to how we extrapolate this from what happened in England to what can happen in November in this country, what do we take from that?
Well, I don't think we have to take anything from it because we already knew it. I mean, come on. We've been watching this, both the Sanders campaign and the Trump campaign, for various different reasons.
But it keeps surprising us.
Well, I don't know why. They both represent a great rejection of the status quo establishment from a society that's very, very frustrated and doesn't trust anybody in authority. So we didn't learn anything from last night in Britain that we haven't known for the last 9 months.
Do you think it will have any effect, any impact, as we see what unfolds over the next several weeks, over the next several months, over the great change that could happen in this country?
Well, there's no question that, for example, Trump is feeding off of these types of things. But, you know, in Britain, they were focusing on the other outside and the fear that more people will come in. Trump's alienating people who already have access to the ballot box. That's a very different situation.
Well, it's always fascinating to speak with you. Stephen Lebo is professor of international history and politics at the Sage Colleges, a regular WAMC commentator, and a frequent guest in this program as well. Stephen, always a pleasure. Have a great weekend. Thank you for being with us.
Here.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.